this is not a great moment for free speech. Suddenly seeing the Trump administration going after green card holders for their speech is obviously not great. In the UK, it's something like 30 people a day being arrested for offensive online communications. My home country of Denmark reintroduced a blasphemy law to prevent Quran burnings. The silver lining of all this is that very often free speech is strengthened on the basis of overreach, of crackdowns, and where people realize that, you know, no, we can't take it for granted.
Hello, welcome back to the Brendan O'Neill Show with me, Brendan O'Neill, and my special guest this week, Yakub Mashangama. Yakub, welcome to the show.
Thank you, Brendan.
It's great to have you back on. We've spoken before. Last time we talked was in relation to your excellent book, Free Speech, A History from Socrates to Social Media. And many listeners will be familiar with your sterling work in defense of freedom of speech as one of the great virtues of a civilized society. And I feel like there's a lot to talk about on this issue. I mean, freedom of speech is always in the news in one way or another, but at the moment it really is front and center in a lot of public discussion, given what's happening in America and also things that are happening in Europe. So to kick us off, I just want to ask you about your optimism levels at the moment in relation to freedom of speech. I think you're one of those people whose optimism levels goes up and down on this question, but I wonder how you're feeling right now, given the things that are going on and which I'm going to ask you about shortly.
Yes, this is not a great moment for free speech, I think. globally, I think... Living in the United States and suddenly seeing the Trump administration going after visa holders, green card holders for their speech is obviously not great. It's something that I've written quite a bit about lately. But I think there's a feeling that the U.S. is retreating from sort of 80 years of really promoting free speech globally, not always consistently, not with a perfect record, but really pulling away from that and using free speech more as a sort of culture war issue rather than any semblance of a principled approach to it. I think that's likely to have really significant ramifications for the state of free speech around the world. Then you have the old world. it was interesting to see Vice President Vance criticizing Europe in Munich a couple of months ago. And he was right on, criticizing European democracies for restricting speech, where you see a tendency, I think. I read this statistic that blew my mind. In the UK, it's something like 30 people a day being arrested for offensive online communications. And this is not something that's unique to the UK. It's even worse in Germany. France is also going in a quite illiberal direction. My home country of Denmark reintroduced a blasphemy law to prevent Quran burnings. So all in all, I would say... It's pretty bleak, especially because the very countries that were supposed to be the guardians of free speech, the traditional heartland of free speech, are now quite happy to restrict this right, all in the name of protecting democracy.
Yeah, that's a very good outline to kick off with. And you're right to raise Britain. I want to ask you about Britain. We need help in this country. things are going pear-shaped very fast in relation to freedom of speech. But let's, before we get into the old world, let's talk about the new world. Let's talk about the United States under Donald Trump. And let's talk about the threat of deportation for dissenters, I guess, for people who say things or think things that the new administration doesn't approve of. Listeners will be very familiar with the case of Mahmoud Khalil. It's been all over the global press for the past few weeks. He is the prominent activist who took part in the Columbia University Gaza protests in last year. I wasn't particularly a fan of those protests. I think lots of strange and odd things were said and done. Having said that, I think the crusade to punish the people who took part in them, and even possibly in his case, to deport them from the country, is incredibly worrying. What have you made of that case and similar cases in the US in relation to deporting people potentially?
Yeah, and there's an even more egregious case, I think, with a PhD student from Tufts University who her only offense, quote unquote, seems to be writing a pretty bland op-ed in a student newspaper, sort of calling for her Tufts University to essentially boycott, divest Israel, which is, you know, pretty common fare on most universities, U.S. universities these days. And of course, you can agree or disagree with that position, but that, you know, deporting, arresting and deporting someone like that in scenes that were a bit reminiscent of, you know, Turkey, really, you know, ICE agents arresting her on the streets in broad daylight is quite frightening. And, you know, we've seen the administration saying they're using AI to scour social media of foreigners, especially students in the country. I think more than 300 people have had their visas revoked. They may not all be due to speech issues, because, you know, there's no transparency, and the administration is not really giving straight up answers and clarifications on where they draw the limit. Essentially, they're using a McCarthy era law, which, among other things, allows Marco Rubio, the Secretary of State, to deport anyone where he is, you know, if he feels that there's a reasonable ground for them to, I think, threaten important foreign policy interests of the United States. And, you know, if threatening the foreign policy interests of the United States, if writing a student op-ed in a student newspaper threatens the foreign policy interests of the U.S., then, you know, you can imagine a lot of speech that would threaten the interest. And what I hear from a lot of other non-citizens who live in this country, many of us who came to the United States because of free speech, I would not have set up a think tank dedicated to global free expression if it wasn't because of the very robust civil libertarian approach to free speech under the First Amendment. You know, but lots of people are now thinking, you know, what can we say? Lots of people are self-censoring their, you know, I speak to people who work in public policy think tanks. They now travel with burner phones. They have, you know, immigration lawyers and speech dial. People are clamoring to have their, you know, bylines removed from articles. They scrub their social media feeds. That's not a great look for a country that, you know, has long branded itself as committed to free speech exceptionalism.
Yeah, quite right. And you wrote an excellent piece on this very question and on the issue of the Department of Homeland Security saying that they will be screening essentially the social media feeds and the output of people who are seeking permanent residence in the US or aspiring to move to the US or aliens in the country to see if they have said anything that might be supportive of, and there's a pretty broad definition, anti-Semitic terrorism, anti-Semitic organizations, anti-Semitic activity, or there's a very broad leeway in relation to any kind of commentary that might threaten American foreign policy in some way.
Yeah. And all that they've also said, you know, but at various times they've also said, you know, if you hate American values or institutions, and I mean, what does that mean? In the piece that you mentioned, I highlight, you know, Christopher Hitchens, a great export of the UK to the US, someone who lived as a green card holder, I believe, until 27 when he became a naturalized citizen. And he certainly did not hold back on criticizing US foreign policy or skewering various US presidents. And no one, I think, you know, no one suggested that, you know, he should pay the price of deportation for that. He was celebrated, even if many disagreed with him. So I think it's a really weird moment.
That's right. And, you know, you mentioned that Christopher Hitchens referred to Reagan as a liar and a trickster. He called Clinton corrupt and selfish. I mean, he was famous for not holding back, even when it came to the leaders of the country that he'd adopted. But I wanted to ask you on that very question and your own position as someone in the US who's works in the field of freedom of speech. You know, most people would accept that if there were an alien in the US who was actively undermining American foreign policy in some way, in a meaningful way, I think most people would accept that there might have to be questions asked about that person. But we are really, in some of these cases, we are very much talking about ideas. We're very much talking about the right to dissent from political thinking in the US, government thinking, the ideals of foreign policy. And when America punishes the dissent of foreigners in America, that's a real problem for the culture of free speech more broadly, isn't it?
Yeah, I completely agree. You know, if Mahmoud Khalil, you know, if the government was to say, listen, we have the receipts, he has been communicating with official Hamas operatives. They have been instructing him to carry out these protests. They have been giving him talking points. He has received funding from Hamas operatives. Then, okay, that's a very different case. Then, you know, it could be material support for terrorism. The standard in the U.S. for when you can punish speech is incredibly high. So it's incitement to imminent lawless action that is also likely to produce such results. And I think there have been cases of that, by the way, where Jewish students have been subject to threats, violence, intimidation, and harassment that would not be protected by the First Amendment. But the government has not made any compelling case, from what I have seen, that this is the case in the specific case of Mahmoud Khalil. So in that sense, it seems to me that, yes, the government is very much seeking actively to punish ideas that it disfavors. And what I think is, you know, there's always, you know, free speech hypocrisy is probably, it's a feature, not a bug of human nature, but it's quite incredible to see so many on the conservative side who have said, you know, the culture of free speech is really important. Yes, we recognize that Harvard and Columbia are private institutions. They're not bound by the First Amendment, so they don't have to protect free speech, but they should, and they're doing a horrible job. Now, suddenly they're saying, well, if the government punishes students for their speech by deporting them, that's not protected by the First Amendment, and it's not even a problem in terms of free speech. And by the way, if you come into this country, exercising free speech is a privilege, and if we don't like you, you get the fuck out. That's essentially the vibe on large parts of the right. I think that's, you know, incredibly, deeply surprising to me. You know, it's not surprising to me that there are some people who will take this position, but it's surprising to me that the upper echelons of the American government with large, seemingly popular support is taking this position.
Starting a business is incredibly rewarding. You have basically infinite freedom to take your very own project in whatever direction you want. But starting and running a business isn't exactly easy. When you're the boss, everything lands on your plate. That's why millions of entrepreneurs are turning to Shopify, a powerful tool that helps lighten the load and streamline the process. Shopify is the commerce platform improving millions of businesses around the world, from brands just getting started to household names like Mattel and Gymshark. Shopify understands that the hardest part of starting a small business is often just getting off the ground. That's why it gives you a built-in design studio packed with hundreds of customizable templates, so you can launch a store that feels like your brand right from day one. Shopify's suite of AI tools makes it easy to write product descriptions and attention-grabbing headlines. And when it comes to spreading the word, you're covered. Shopify helps you build email and social media campaigns so your business shows up wherever your customers do. And that's not all. One of Shopify's biggest strengths is its know-how. Whether it's handling returns, managing shipping, or keeping track of inventory, Shopify supports you at every turn. If you're ready to sell, you're ready for Shopify. Turn your big business idea into with Shopify on your side. Sign up for your £1 per month trial period and start selling today at shopify.co.uk/Brendan. That's shopify.co.uk/Brendan to start selling today.
Yeah, it's surprising. It's shocking. It's incredibly frustrating. I feel often like I'm banging my head against a brick wall trying to explain to people that if you're not consistent on free speech, then it's not free speech. I mean, that's the point that you make very often, and I try to make too. I want to ask you in relation to the piece you wrote on this. You know, one of the great things about the United States is that it has historically had this devotion to freedom of speech. Constitutionally, it's, you know, I often dream of having a First Amendment in the UK, an amendment that, you know, forbids the government from interfering with speech or publication or religion and so on. That would be a good thing. And that's one of the reasons America has attracted people from around the world, people fleeing religious persecution or political persecution, people who want to have that fundamental right to speak, to express themselves, to say what they believe. And you give examples in your piece about other historical instances where people have sought refuge in a country that is freer than their own. So you talk about Spinoza going to the Dutch Republic. Spinoza, one of the great Enlightenment figures who made a better defense of freedom of speech than so many other people in history. Just talk a little bit about the role that those kind of nations have played historically in allowing dissenters, instead of kicking dissenters out, actually allowing them to come so that they can speak their minds.
Yeah, no, I think you can start even earlier. I think you can start in the ancient Athenian democracy, right? You know, Aristotle is not an Athenian citizen, but Athens allows him, you know, he's there, he's a pupil of Plato, and then he sets up his own academy. And that was not, you know, uncommon. So lots of great philosophers and thinkers were attracted to Athens because it had this conception of free speech called paresia, meaning fearless speech that was enjoyed even by non-citizens. So I don't think you can underestimate the importance of brilliant minds of the ancient world being attracted to this free speech zone. You know, what would Western philosophy look like if that had not been the case? And I think the Dutch Republic is another great example. You know, it opened up its doors to Jews fleeing from Inquisition in Portugal. Particularly, it opened up to French Huguenots, Protestants fleeing persecution from France. Even John Locke spent time in the Dutch Republic, writing celebrated works there. And it became the printing house of Europe. It became this place where lots of daring free thinkers who said things that were outrageous in their homelands and most other places in Europe. And it became this cauldron of intellectual daring ideas that had an outsized impact, I think, on sort of the early Enlightenment. So I think throughout history, you really see these examples of states that are open to people coming in with ideas that challenge the status quo, that might even challenge basic values of that state. And that has huge benefits for free expression, but also just for civilization as such. Now, and I don't think, you know, I think you can still, that does not mean that you have to be in favor of open immigration as such. You know, I was very heavily vetted before I was let into the US. I think that's fine. You know, you can say, you know, we don't want everyone, you know, we want restrictive policies, but once you let people in, once you let them start a life, you know, being at a university and so on, punishing them for their speech, I think is incompatible with the underlying idea of free expression.
Yeah, definitely. You know, here in Britain, we have a lot to thank the Dutch Republic for as well, because a lot of the pamphlets that stirred up the revolutionary sentiment that transformed us into a democracy, a lot of those pamphlets had to be published in the Dutch Republic and then secreted back into the UK and distributed in pubs and so on. So
Jan Lilburn was one, right?
Yes,
that's right. The levelers, these oft-forgotten heroes whose ideas of free speech and equality are, you know, very early and really astounding. They had that connection with the Dutch Republic. So that's another good example.
Yeah. Okay, just sticking with America for a bit more, I wanted to ask you about one of the arguments we're hearing from people, and I'm even hearing this from quite sensible people who are normally on the side of freedom of speech, but they're wobbling. They're starting to wobble. And one argument that they're making is that, well, you know, the rights that free-born Americans enjoy, native-born Americans, people who are proper citizens of the USA and have been there for a long time, those rights don't necessarily apply to green card holders or people aspiring to be American citizens or people visiting America. To me, that's an overly technical argument. And I think the broader argument, which is that the culture of freedom of speech suffers if you forbid dissent from someone simply because he's a foreigner, I think that still holds. But what do you say to that? What do you say to those who say, well, you know, these are
green card holders, these are aspiring citizens. They have to keep their nose clean. They should keep their heads down. They should watch themselves for a few years, and then they can say what they want to say. How do you respond to that?
So obviously there are some rights that I don't get to enjoy and that I understand. I can't vote in elections. I think that's obviously perfectly reasonable. It would be mad to just open the doors to everyone comes in, and then they can vote before they go through the process of becoming a citizen. But freedom of expression, I think, you know, the American tradition builds on essentially the idea that freedom of expression is not a license granted by government. It's a natural right. And it's the role of government to uphold that. So, you know, if it's a natural right, why would you distinguish between citizens and non-citizens? And I also think just from a purely, you know, utilitarian point of view, it doesn't make a lot. You know, are you saying that does America not benefit from the voices of foreigners? I think there's the statistic that I wrote another piece on this, and I think 35% of Nobel laureates from who are sort of U.S. affiliated were immigrants or born outside the country. Around 50% of unicorn companies, so companies with a worth of more than $1 billion, have founders born outside the U.S. So ask yourself, like, would you go to the U.S. to pursue an academic career, or, you know, work 100 hours a week, spend all your savings to set up a successful company? If, you know, one day Stephen Miller wakes up, sees your tweet and says, no, I don't like this guy, you know, we'll deport him. You know, of course not. Of course, free speech and freedom of expression for non-citizens is a huge advantage to the United States, one that has allowed their universities for, you know, we can have all these gripes about the state of U.S. universities, but they're still world-class in many departments and the envy of many others. They wouldn't be that, you know, if they operated on the Russian or the Chinese model, right? And also, I would just say for those Americans, go back and read Thomas Jefferson and James Madison, because this is not a new debate. So in 1798, the Alien Act was adopted, which allowed the president basically to deport anyone who he felt was a threat or threat to the safety of the United States or had machinations against the government. And Madison writes a very detailed criticism and rebuttal, and he repudiates this idea that, you know, foreigners should not have rights. And he says, of course, it's a punishment if you deport someone who has moved to the United States to enjoy liberties that they could not enjoy anywhere else. Thomas Jefferson calls it, I think, a detestable law worthy of the 8th or 9th century. So these are the, like, founders of the United States. James Madison is the architect of the First Amendment, and he certainly would not, I think, be in favor of this law.
Yeah, yeah. Always worth reminding ourselves what the actual founders of the US said before we rush into any of these discussions. You talked earlier about how surprised you were and disappointed you were that, you know, so many conservatives who for the past 10 or 20 years have been bemoaning cancel culture, especially on campuses, you know, they have become converts to the cause of punishing dissent, and punishing it in a very extreme way. As you say, throwing someone out of the country is a severe punishment. And it feels to me like on both sides of this discussion right now, we've got people who I'm not convinced are serious free speech warriors. So we've got the conservatives who are saying, kick them out. Don't say anything bad on your social media. Otherwise, you won't be allowed into America. So they've suddenly abandoned their supposed commitment to freedom of speech. But then on the other side, if you see the kind of some on the left who are rallying around Mahmoud Khalil, these are not people who have traditionally defended freedom of speech. And in fact, some of them are people who have been enforcing cancel culture on campuses for the past few years. How do you cut through that? Because you presumably find yourself having fleeting allies at a certain period and maybe understanding that they're not going to be by your side all the time on this question.
Yeah, I think unfortunately that's, that's just, you know, the business of free speech, right? You don't have permanent allies. You can try and expand the base as best you can by hopefully providing persuasive arguments by building a free speech movement that tries to transcend political differences. But I think there's always this temptation for people to rally around free speech when it supports your underlying ideology. And we see that, you know, it's really, you know, up until 5 minutes ago, it was high fashion among people on the left, also First Amendment experts, to sort of say, well, the First Amendment is out of control, or the First Amendment entrenches white supremacist male values and is sort of weaponized against minorities. A view which, in my opinion, is entirely at odds with the development of the First Amendment, especially in the 20th century. But that was the case that they made, that minority groups needed protection, and the free speech was essentially just a ploy to be used by powerful white males to silence the powerless. Now, some of these people on the left, who 5 minutes ago were arguing for limiting free speech, are sort of taking up the cause of free speech and saying that, you know, complaining that the Trump administration is violating this sacred American value that they wanted restricted before. And some of the, of course, some, as you rightly said, you know, there have certainly been instances in the US and around the world post October 7th, where people have said things that were anti-Semitic, were, supportive of Hamas, or, you know, at least sort of justified a terrorist attack, right? And I think it's quite clear that a lot of the people who are now saying this speech should be protected from the overreach of the Trump administration would not be making that argument if this type of speech was labeled against other minority groups, for instance. And so this is the incredibly frustrating thing. And so if you were sort of a culture warrior like Chris Rufo, you might just, you know, be laughing it up and saying, well, you're just getting your just deserves. But I don't think that's a very constructive way to go about preserving free speech. It's not about who started it or who, you know, how do you unravel all of that history? Because, you know, most people are not very principled. So you just have to stay, I think, loyal to the principle of free speech and call it out on an equal basis as best you can, and realize that very often you'll be abandoned as the political winds change. I'm quite certain that if in 4 years' time we have a president and a Congress that is Democrat rather than Republican, I'm pretty sure that there will be a renewed sense of sort of, okay, we want to get back at the overreach of the Trump administration, and how can we ensure that something like this never happens again? Well, maybe we need laws against disinformation or right-wing extremism or the like. And then, you know, we go again.
Yeah. I think, you know, if freedom of speech becomes a weapon in the culture war, it's going to be disastrous. You know, if it's used as a weapon by the right sometimes and then by the left at other times, I think we miss the true purpose of it, which is that it's not a weapon in a culture war, but it's a principle by which we should live our lives. And in relation to that, I wanted to ask you how you cut through that frustration that sometimes the right, sometimes conservatives are on the side of freedom of speech, sometimes they're not, and the same with the left. What argument do you make to those flighty defenders of freedom of speech, if we're going to be polite, in order to try to convince them that moral consistency on freedom of speech is not just a pose, it's not just a posture, it's absolutely essential to the real meaning of freedom of speech?
I think, first of all, you just have to, you yourself have to sort of show that you're willing to defend free speech across the board. So I think that's one step one. If you're not yourself credible, and if you yourself have sort of ideological red lines or sort of taboos or double standards, then you really have no standing. Then secondly, you Of course, you could be a little bit strategic. So I often, when I speak to sort of more liberal leftist groups, I will talk about the essential role that free speech has played for minorities, the civil rights movement, someone like Frederick Douglass, and so on. And I think you could, you know, maybe with conservatives, if you use Jefferson and Madison, that is something that might appeal to people who are sort of more traditional conservatives, at least. This new brand of conservatives, I'm not sure that that principle really cuts that deep. But yeah, I don't know any other way than being principled and consistent yourself, arguing in good faith, and showing that you're willing to stand up for them when they're on the receiving side. Maybe there are better ways to go about it. I hope so, because it's not exactly like the current free speech movement, such as it is like a massively popular one, I would say. That's my best bet, really.
Yeah, it's a shame that people who live the truth of freedom of speech are few and far between at the moment. I mean, there's you, of course. We do it as Spiked. We defend freedom of speech for everyone, regardless of what they say. Our friends at Fire do it brilliantly as well. Yeah. You know, that kind of consistency is just so important. Yeah. And acting it out in the world by defending everyone's speech, regardless of whether you like it or dislike it, is so important.
And I think, you know, especially, you know, obviously, even though you and I might call ourselves consistent and principled free speech defenders, we still have our biases. We still have, you know, positions on various issues. And I think a good way to train yourself to be consistent is to really speak out when you're most tempted to compromise your principles and speak out for the rights of people who you really dislike, and where you sort of have almost convinced yourself that, oh, maybe there's a slight exception here, because human beings are really good at coming up with these convincing justifications for why free speech does not apply to those we disagree with. So training yourself to defy that temptation, I think, is essential.
Yeah, freedom for the thought that we hate. You know, what happened to those brilliant slogans from the not too distant past, in fact?
Well, I think you're right. That I have to say that Fire, where I'm also a senior fellow, have, I think, gotten recognition because they, you know, they were often maligned as sort of a conservative group. And I think they've shown that that they are consistent and principled. We try, you know, the Future of Free Speech that I run here try to do the same thing. And I think that's, and maybe the recognition will, typically, I think you, some time has to pass. And then when you look back at a special, you know, at a period of time where tensions were high, you know, you try to make sense of it all, and hopefully there will be some lessons that will say, well, the positions that this group took has been borne out by time, but it might not be sort of values or lessons that crystallize until a certain time has elapsed.
Hi, it's Brendan here. I just wanted to remind you that you can still buy my latest book. It's called After the Pogrom, 7th of October, Israel and the Crisis of Civilization, and it's available right now from Amazon. I'm really proud of this book. It is an unflinching account of how the West failed the moral test of 7th of October 2023, which of course is the day that Hamas and other militants invaded Israel and unleashed barbarism. The book documents in pretty chilling detail how activists, academics, and others in the West ended up making excuses for Hamas's violence, ended up taking the side of the pogromists against the pogrom's victims, and ended up in the process turning their backs on the values of civilization. The book is fundamentally a call to arms for Western civilization. It makes the case for restoring Enlightenment values and standing with Israel while it's under attack by radical Islamists. I don't know if an author is allowed to describe his own book as essential reading, but I really do think it's essential reading. It's called After the Pogrom, 7th of October, Israel and the Crisis of Civilization, and you can get your copy right now from Amazon.
Yeah, exactly. We patiently await the favor of posterity. That will shine on us one day, I'm sure. I want to ask you now about the old world, and
Europe, a place both you and I are from. And I want to talk to you about, to kick off with, how the old world is becoming the really old world in relation to clampdowns on supposedly blasphemous speech. You mentioned Denmark and the whole discussion about burning Korans. There's discussions around that in Sweden as well, of course. And in the UK, there are moves by the Labour government to bring in a new definition of Islamophobia, which wouldn't be a law, but it would influence public institutions and public bodies and lead to a chilling of discussion around Islam and even radical Islam and so on. This is a threat to free speech that never seems to go away. In one way or another, there is always these discussions about the supposed problem of Islamophobia and what must be done about it. What do you make of where that is at the moment, that discussion?
Yeah, it's in a dark place. I think it was highly symbolic when the Danish government in 2023 caved in. You know, this year is the 20th anniversary of the Danish cartoons published by Jyllands-Posten, the Danish newspaper, that really set off a firestorm and made sort of the question of free speech and religion a burning global issue. And what happened to Charlie Hebdo, for instance, is downstream from Jyllands-Posten because Charlie Hebdo republished some of those cartoons. And the Danish governments over time stood firm. They refused to condemn the newspaper. They refused to introduce blasphemy laws. They defied boycotts and diplomatic pressure, threats from terrorist groups that you know could have resulted in pretty devastating mass terrorist attacks with multiple killings of civilians, only to then cave in. In 2023, after you know these far right protesters burned Korans, and of course you know burning a Koran might not be the most eloquent way to make your point, and they were deliberatively provocative, but that's part and parcel of free expression, in my view. And I think burning a Koran or the Constitution or a flag is you know a symbolic protest that should be protected, and no religion or philosophy or doctrine should have any special protection. You know, it's quite absurd that if I go to Denmark and I stand in front of parliament and I burn the Danish constitution, that's perfectly protected. But if I burn the Quran, I risk imprisonment for doing so. And I think that Denmark became a domino piece that fell and set in motion a chain reaction, because as long as Denmark stood up, you know, I think that maybe emboldened other democracies saying, you know, okay, we can't compromise. But then suddenly you see Sweden using its hate speech laws to go after these Iraqi refugees that had burned the Quran as a protest against Islamism. What's even more tragic is that one of these refugees was shot and murdered a few days before the verdict, while the other one was still, you know, convicted and fined. And now we're seeing in the UK someone protesting by burning a Quran outside, I think, the Turkish consulate, am I right, is facing charges that seem to be stretching the law. And based on this premise, and I think it's fear probably that's driving this, but also maybe a sense that in the old world that Europe does no longer have the geopolitical clout that we once have. So we need favors from Turkey, we need favors from you know the Gulf states and so on, and therefore we have to sacrifice free speech a little bit. And I think that's really disturbing, and that's also one of the reasons why I fear the consequences of the U.S. sort of pulling away from promoting free speech globally, because they have sort of been a backstop. Without them there, I don't see Europe sort of promoting free speech globally. And whereas you see a number of countries like China, Russia, really aggressively pushing these illiberal norms, human rights norms, including the subversion of free speech in international fora. And so if Europe is essentially internalizing those red lines in national criminal law, you know, what's the end point?
Yeah, I mean, it's shocking the extent to which, you know, the clampdowns on so-called Islamophobia in Europe are in many ways that they come across like an extension of the war on blasphemy in the Muslim world. You know, and there's often an interplay between those two things. Firstly, in terms of the very idea itself, that the Quran should be a privileged book beyond criticism, beyond mockery. But also, as you say, because it seems Europe, some European nations are, you know, they need favors from countries in the Muslim world and therefore they don't want to upset them. So it's a very dispiriting state of affairs. Do you think one of the problems is with the very idea of Islamophobia? And this is not to, diminish the fact that there is anti-Muslim bigotry in Europe. It's a problem. We should talk about it. But Islamophobia is something slightly different, isn't it? And I wonder if it's that idea itself that really needs to be kind of taken down.
Yeah, because what does it mean, right? You know, Islam is a religion. And one of the reasons why European Western democracies are comparatively free and open is because we have fought very hard to be able to criticize religion, to question religion, to be skeptical about the truth of revealed religion and so on. And so to introduce this idea that if somehow a religion needs specific deference goes against hundreds of years of shaping open free democracies. So I don't like that term. As you said, anti-Muslim bigotry is certainly an issue that's different. I personally don't think that you should punish even hate speech labeled against Muslims or Jews or whatever. But I recognize the difference between someone vehemently criticizing the religion of Islam and someone accusing all Muslims of being terrorists, for instance. There's a very important moral distinction between these two. But when one of the things that I think is, this is again to do with the free speech hypocrisy, post October 7th, there's been a real clampdown on pro-Palestinian speech and protest in many European countries. Really, really disturbing degrees to which people are being prosecuted and so on for pro-Palestinian speech. But very often, some of those who are saying, you know, Western countries are hypocrites and so on, are, you know, people who 5 minutes ago were insisting that, you know, you can't poke fun of the Prophet Muhammad, for instance. And so this is again one of those where no one can seize the value of being principled, you know. And it's something that I've made this argument so many times to Muslims when I've been debating these issues. You know, you're a minority in Europe. You know, if you argue for limits on free speech, they will be decided and determined by a majority. That majority might one day be a majority that has different ideas than you. They might even try to punish you. But that just has not made headway at all. So it's sort of the worst of both worlds, right? Instead of saying, you know, no group should have special protection, we're saying, you know, every group should have their sacred taboos protected and sacrifice principle along the way.
It's and the issue of Palestine protests is such a good example, because there are severe clampdowns on that particular form of protest, which is an intolerable assault on people's freedom of speech and their freedom of association. But as you say, the other thing that a lot of those people complaining now about the clampdown on their freedom of speech, they are also often active supporters of the boycott, divestment and sanctions movement, which is very often not just a movement to prevent Western countries from importing Israeli stuff, but even from allowing Israeli art and books and dance troupes and actors and all sorts of people from coming over to perform. So it has this really incredibly censorious element to it as well.
And the same on US college camp, you know, on US college campuses, some of the people who might be in danger of being deported, being, you know, targeted by the administration were student groups that were advocating that, you know, no speakers who support Israel or sort of pro-Jewish should be allowed to speak on college campuses, right? So,
just one more question in relation to this is on the emboldening effect, which I think is, it's something that people are very reluctant to talk about often, but it seems clear to me that, you know, the moral cowardice of Europe in the face of whether it's countries in the Muslim world or just the very idea that we should have the right to criticize Islam and the Quran, that moral cowardice is not just annoying and a pain in the neck to people like you and me who like freedom of speech. It's also quite dangerous, isn't it? Because it emboldens the extremists. And, you know, I often think the Charlie Hebdo case, and it was the 10th anniversary this year, I think that's a good example of it, because if you grow up in a country, as those two killers did, in which the signal from officialdom all the time is that it's really bad to criticize Islam, it's bad to hurt Muslims' feelings, we should, you know, protect them from any kind of bad feeling or any attack on their self-esteem or self-worth, etc., you're going to develop that into something of a personality and you're going to become a more intolerant person. Then, of course, after Charlie Hebdo, you have these American novelists and Western and European intellectuals who just said, well, you know, if only it hadn't published all those cartoons of Muhammad, maybe this wouldn't have happened. And all that excuse making and apologism, it really is quite a dangerous phenomenon, isn't it?
Yeah, I mean, I call it the jihadist veto. And I think the jihadist veto, unfortunately, is winning, or at least making headway. So, because most people don't like to admit that they're afraid or that they cave out of fear. And so they'll rationalize it by making these transparently bad faith arguments about the need for tolerance. You know, oh, tolerance now no longer means suffering, you know, ideas that you don't like. Now tolerance means that you have to ban ideas that you don't like in order to protect supposedly vulnerable, marginalized groups, rather than, you know, look the other way, saying, you know, the only reason why a minority group, including Muslims in the West, can live and express their faith is because of religious freedom and freedom of expression, right? There's this great video by Shiraz Maher, who used to be a member of Hizb ut-Tahrir in the UK, and he talks about this epiphany he had when he was protesting with Hizb ut-Tahrir in London, you know, with their black flags and so on. And suddenly, it dawned on him that, you know, I'm expressing my, you know, I'm using the rights guaranteed in the UK to free speech and assembly, but if I was in power, if Hizb ut-Tahrir got their way, if they were to establish a global caliphate, we would take away all those rights. And then suddenly sort of his worldview fell apart. That was the sort of sudden realization that that made it impossible for him to stay with Hizb ut-Tahrir. And I think that is something that's an argument we need to make much more forcefully, rather than coming up with these weasel words about, oh, we need respect and tolerance, and that means refraining from criticizing religion or, you know, poking fun at religious figures if that's what you feel like doing.
Yeah. Okay, I want to ask you about Britain. We're struggling here in the UK in relation to a freedom that we did so much to found and to promote. You know, many of the great free speech thinkers come from the UK. I want to ask you about a case involving a woman called Lucy Connolly, which I'm sure you will have heard of. So Lucy Connolly is a woman who has been given a 31-month prison sentence, like literally in a prison cell. This is not an exaggeration. Yeah. for writing a tweet during the Southport riots last year. It's broadly agreed that this was a very obnoxious tweet and a hateful tweet. So she said, burn down the hotels. I don't care if the immigrants are in there. Deport them all, et cetera, et cetera. And for that, she was jailed for 31 months. How do you address a case like this? This case, at last, rather belatedly, is causing shock in this country. It's been brought to people's attention by Alison Pearson at the Daily Telegraph. And people are really shocked that this could happen in Britain in the 2020s. What have you made of this case? And what do you think it tells us about what's happening in the UK right now?
Yeah, so, you know, just in, on principle, this would be a case that would not reach the threshold that I would prefer. I don't think it would be constitute incitement to imminent lawless action if we were to use sort of the First Amendment standard. I also think that she deleted her comment, right? It is obviously an obnoxious one and an extremely insensitive and one that in the abstract seems to suggest that she's fine with the death of innocence. But look, are we safer in a country where we don't know that there are people who harbor these expressions and where we're not allowed, you know, we don't allow people to vent frustrations? I don't think so. You know, I want personally, I'm someone who I'd rather know that there are people who hold intolerant views. I am also knowing that human beings are emotional creatures, and that when something like the Southport massacre happens, people are, you know, likely to respond in an emotional way, especially when you have social media, and write things that may not reflect them, you know, reflect their true views on things. I think that's better that, you know, allow them that outlet than the opposite. But even if you were to say, you know, we need hate speech laws in place, I think the idea of sending someone to prison for 31 months for a tweet is, you know, completely incompatible with any notion of freedom of expression. It's a draconian sentence, I think. And I think that there were quite a few draconian sentences meted out in the aftermath of the Southport killings.
Yeah, there were, and it's finally stirring up a bit of discussion here at last. Okay, I wanted to ask you one final question, just in relation to, I mean, it's a big question. You might not be able to answer all of it, but in relation to the old world versus the new world, and who might we trust to defend freedom of speech? Because I have to confess to you that when J.D. Vance did his talk in Munich, and he really gave Europe a telling off, and he said, look, you guys have lost the plot. You're jailing people for saying things. You're censoring people from praying outside clinics. You're doing all sorts of things you shouldn't be doing. I must say that I found that quite thrilling, and I was cheering him on in parts because what he was saying was correct. And then, of course, it slowly dawns on you that the Trump administration can't really be trusted with freedom of speech either. So what do you think happens next? I mean, if America is no longer a reliable partner on the question of freedom, and Europe is, you know, doing everything within its power to move itself away from the old ideals of freedom, what do you think comes next? How do we tackle this kind of transatlantic crisis of freedom of speech?
Well, I still think that in the US, you have seen protests, huge debates about the Trump administration's crackdown on free speech. You know, I think it would be pretty, I don't think you would see the same popular resistance in Europe. You know, someone like Mahmoud Khalil, you know, it's quite astounding, actually, that there are so many people who are demonstrating. You know, you have and politicians getting involved. I don't necessarily think that would happen in Europe. I don't see a lot of popular resistance against the steady erosion of free speech in Europe. So that sort of makes me think that the US might still be the best bet, and that the Americans, even if, you know, my organization has measured attitudes towards free speech in 33 countries around the world, and we saw that American attitudes in general sort of dropped, or the support for free speech dropped. But I still think that there's more of an attachment to free speech among Americans than Europeans, and that they are more jealous of free speech when it's being encroached upon by the government. So maybe there will be this backlash, and that, you know, that might be sort of the silver lining of all this, is that very often free speech is strengthened on the basis of overreach, of crackdowns, and where people realize that, you know, no, we can't take it for granted. We thought we could take free speech for granted, but now we see that it is the instrument that is being used to take away our rights more broadly. And therefore, we have to galvanize support for free speech. So that would be the silver lining. If that likely to happen in Europe? I'm not seeing any clear signs of that, I would say. But I would love for the UK to rekindle its commitment to free speech.
Jakub, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you for listening to The Brendan O'Neill Show. We'll be back with another guest and more discussion. Don't forget to subscribe. And in the meantime, keep reading Spiked at www.spiked-online.com.